The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello again. If Sarah Crown and I sound a bit breathless on this podcast, please excuse us. It's because we're recording only minutes after hearing that the Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa has confounded all the tipsters to win this year's Nobel Prize for Literature. As you're listening to this, of course, it's yesterday's news, and you can read all about it on our book's website, thanks to the heroic efforts of Sarah and her team. So we've decided to keep this podcast a Nobel-free zone and concentrate on two other big news events of this busy literary week. We're going to focus on children's books and on poetry, including some original recordings. A recording there of Alfred Lord Tennyson from 1890, published this week by the British Library for National Poetry Day. We'll also be discussing the results of the Forward Poetry Prize and hearing more historic recordings. This week, we also announce the winner of the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize. Sarah, would you do the honours?
Yes, I think this might be the first time I've ever done this. The winner of this year's Guardian Children's Fiction Prize...
Da-dum!
Thank you for the sound effect, is Michelle Paver for Ghost Hunter.
It's the sixth and final book in her series about the Stone Age. It's a considerable achievement, and we'll hear Michelle herself in a minute. But first, another piece of history. Way back at the shortlisting stage in the summer, we eavesdropped on some of our judges discussing the merits of their chosen best four books. Julie Eccleshare, our children's books editor, is chair of the group.
So we've read through the whole submission that you've all seen, and now we've got to really focus on the four books that we think this year are going to be the books that are the most important books. Jenny, you were very interested in the characters' voices.
Certainly. I mean, Unhooking the Moon, in the character of Rats, I think there's a generosity and clear-sightedness about her that it almost feels like here's a writer who doesn't know the rules. I was immediately charmed by her. She's a 10-year-old with epilepsy, and he uses the epilepsy as a way into visions, almost as narrative hooks, so that she might meet a drug dealer or a street hustler or a rapper. And she just has this sort of charming, clear-sighted, generous way of meeting new people. It just feels like, to have a book where the protagonist is A, 10 years old, and B, a visionary, and C, an outsider and homeless, just felt incredibly brave.
Without it in any way seeming like a problem novel. I mean, that was what was exciting about it.
Yes.
Mal, morality was something you were quite interested in what we were saying, as it were, what kind of messages we were getting through.
I have to agree with what Jenny said about Unhooking the Moon. I thought it was just an extraordinary kind of debut, really. All these books have great voices. Eva Ibbotson's just wonderful. It's like having to me, it was like having your like favorite crazy granny telling you a wonderful story that felt almost improvised as it went along. It was totally anarchic. I mean, it's very, very clever to achieve that effect. I don't imply that, you know, Eva just sort of tossed it off, you know, but it's very, very clever. But it has that feel of you know, fluidity and just fun. It's very fun. There are lines in that make you laugh aloud, and there are sly bits. And then Michelle Paver has also got this... this is the sixth of a series, of amazing, amazing series of... with her, it's not actually so much a voice as a vision, really. I mean, it's just an amazing way of imagining in fine detail what weather and animal skin and smells and thorns and stuff. And the voice of Wolf, yes. That's another... I mean, just such good books. Who haven't we talked about?
We haven't talked about Morris's books. Morris Gleitzman's the last of his trilogy. Linda, you were very taken with the idea of writing about the Holocaust in that kind of way.
The thing about Morris Gleitzman's voice is that you just feel so aware that you're in the presence of a really great storyteller. And it would have been so easy to have this a story that was overly sentimental, and in fact it just hit all the right notes all the way through. There's an intelligence about the way he deals with emotion, which I think is hugely impressive. I think Michelle Paver is such an achievement two. I think this is book six, isn't it? It's the final volume in the series. And she's created a whole world, which is both eminently believable, but what I have to say, what I really enjoyed about this book was her voice. Her use of the English language is masterful and kind of poetic, but at the same time really child-friendly.
And for me, one of the things about the list that we come up with this year that I think is very exciting is that these are all very real children's books. Often we find ourselves moving more and more towards teen fiction, partly because sometimes that's where the sort of literary fireworks are in children's writing. But this year we seem to have this raft of absolutely the kind of books that I think will make readers.
Pretty much age-proof, really. I mean, the Eve Robinson's course is for a younger readership, I think, than the other three. But I'm sure an older child can read that and get the jokes and the lovely wordplay and the sort of inversions that go on, you know, like the hypochondriac, doomy ogre who just wants to die to join his wife in a grave and all that stuff, you know. You don't have to be you can take that book on so many different levels, for example. It's just absolute joy.
So
but all the other, but all four of these stories are stories. And they are stories that you get engaged in and that have narrative arcs that draw you in, and they have suspense and they have surprises and they have all that good old-fashioned, in the best sense, stuff.
What
is all in there, isn't it?
We don't really want to say old-fashioned, do we? We want to. I mean, there's another word that we want.
Because like classic, I suppose.
Yeah. Timeless.
Timeless, there you
but
are.
But there is something about the stories that we want children to read. These are stories we really want children to read. These are the kinds of books that show that reading isn't difficult, it's not, an arcane art form, and this is actually the stuff that makes all the other media that they then go and enjoy. But it was writ here first, as it were. It was written in this story form. And the cleverness of these writers is the way that they tell the story through the characters, through that expression of the characters, that makes it all work so well. And I think actually young readers will particularly like Michelle Paver's world, because in a way, I don't wish to make it sound sort of trivialised in any sense, but it is the creation of a complete world, which is very much what a lot of they're doing. A lot of the other times they're doing, they're doing things with other media. So I think it's a very wonderful creation.
Yeah, and what I like about that too is that there's no kind of sort of dead info. There's no kind of non-fiction bits in her stories. I mean, we learn all these strange crafts and rituals and stuff.
Yes,
but it's actually we discover those things because it's what the characters are doing.
Yeah,
there's none of that kind of rather tiresome historical fiction background in you sometimes get. You know,
yes, we can.
We've got these four. We're very equally poised. We've got to come down with one. This has been a very, very tight decision. Agony, really. Horrible to think that they can't all be the winner. Linda, what are you going to pick and why?
I have to say that Gregory Hughes's book, Unhooking the Moon, there's a fresh feel about this novel. I've never read anything quite like it. The character of the rat was just fantastic, and I'm sure that she will become a classic character in children's fiction. But I think it's got to be Michelle Paver for me, because of the sheer craftsmanship of her writing, because of the epic story, because I love the language that she uses for the wolf, and it was just full of drama and suspense.
I think, Michelle Paver, what she does with this book is she does the thing which I think every novelist strives to do, which is to pluck you up and take you somewhere else. And I was there. I was 6,000 years ago sitting in the Ice Age, absolutely freezing. And I think, all the things they do, the tracking, the surviving, it's so vivid, so interesting. She writes beautiful, simple, lyrical words. You read it and you think that, yep, that exactly sums up exactly that. I can see it. There's narrative tension. The story bounds along. I think it's a wonderful book.
Thanks very much, everyone. That was the most fantastic judging session. We have come up, I think, with a superb winner this year in Michelle Paver's Ghost Hunter. It is the end of a sequence of books which has delighted children for quite a lot of years now, and it is wonderful to be able to give her the Guardian Children's Book Prize this year to mark that achievement.
Julie Eccleshare with her fellow judges Jenny Downham, Linda Buckley Archer, and last year's winner Mal Peet. So lucky Michelle Paver came out just on top of a very talented group. Before she even knew the result, in fact, way back when Ghost Hunter was first published, she came in to talk to Michelle Pawley all about it.
You need to take your mind back 6,000 years to the Stone Age. If you want to get technical, it's the late Mesolithic. So we're in the time of the hunter-gatherers. The story takes place in Northern Europe, somewhere in Northern Europe. And the hero is Torak. He starts off as a boy of 12 in Wolf Brother, the first book. His father's killed and he has to fulfil his destiny throughout the six books by fighting and defeating seven evil soul eaters, mages, who've gone to the bad. But he has two friends. He makes friends with a girl called Wren from the Raven Clan, who's a good friend to have because she's the best shot in the forest with a bow and arrow. And he makes friends with a wolf cub called Wolf. And part of the story is told through Wolf's point of view, and I've tried to make him a real wolf, and Torak and Wren real hunter-gatherers. So it's an adventure story, but with a hunter-gatherer flavour.
And their adventure concludes in Ghost Hunter,
that's
last
right.
Book.
Ghost Hunter is the one where the stakes are highest, because there's only one Soul Eater left, and she's the scariest of all. She's Eostra, the Eagle Owl Mage, and it's winter, and Torak and Wren and Wolf have to confront Eostra in her lair in the Mountain of Ghosts. And she's plotting to rule the world, basically, and she wants to rule not only the living, but the dead. So in a sense, it brings the story, and Torek's story in particular, full circle. I'm going to read a bit from the middle. You don't need to know the story, of course, for Ghost Hunter yet. It's winter, as I said, and for days, Torak and Wren and Wolf have been struggling across the snowbound fells in search of the mountain clans. But they haven't eaten for 2 days. And while this is no problem for Wolf, it's a big problem for Torak and Wren, and they're getting weak. They've got to find food. And on the fells, that means reindeer. By mid-morning, they reached a river, which, surprisingly, was still awake. It rushed noisily between stony hills crowned with three more of the strange turf men. Its shallows were free of ice. Torak and Wren grubbed up clumps of brilliant green horsetails and munched the swollen root buds raw. As he straightened up, Torak's head whirled. The horsetails had done little to assuage his hunger. His belly was beginning to hurt. Wren slumped on a rock and took off her snow mask. Her eyes were ringed with blue shadows. "You'd think there'd be fish in it," she said, "but I haven't seen any." They glanced at each other. How long could they carry on? "When we find the reindeer," said Torak, "I'm going to eat a whole one, starting at the neck and working my way down. I'll kill another one for you." She smiled wanly. He squatted to refill his water skin. "What river is this, anyway?" "I don't know and I don't care. If I don't get meat soon, I'll eat my medicine pouch." But Torak had stopped listening. Whipping off his mitten, he plucked something from the water. "What is it?" said Wren. He showed her. A light brown hair, as long as his thumb. Reindeer. "They must be upstream," said Wren. They listened. The river was too loud. Its banks were boulder-strewn and impassable. They'd have to make a lengthy detour around the hills or climb them. They decided to climb. It would be quicker and give them a better view of what lay on the other side. Climbing proved harder than they expected. Torak was appalled at how weak he'd become. Black spots swam before his eyes, and every step was an effort. Beside him, Wren's breath came in gasps. Wolf appeared above them, pausing beside a turf man before racing down to Torak. His fur was fluffed up with excitement. "Reindeer, hurry! We hunt!" Torak translated for Wren. Behind her snow mask, her eyes gleamed. "Let's go." Swiftly, Torak told his pack brother in wolf talk that he must hunt without them, as he'd have a better chance of making a kill. Wolf didn't argue and disappeared over the hill. The thrill of the hunt gave Torak and Wren new strength. As they neared the top of the hill, they dropped to the ground and belly crawled. Reindeer have keen senses. If there were any on the other side, it was vital not to spook them. Slipping his bow from his shoulder, Torak took an arrow from his quiver. Wren had already done so. She'd also tied back her red hair and tucked it inside her hood so the prey couldn't see. Catching his eye, she touched her clan creature feathers and gave him her familiar sharp-toothed grin. The wind chilled Torak's face. Good! It was blowing his scent away from the prey. Stealthily he crawled forwards. He crested the ridge. He caught his breath. Below him the hill fell away to the glittering sweep of the river. Another river flowed across it, a river of reindeer. Clouds of frosty breath hazed golden in the sun from thousands of muzzles. The air rang with the bleating of calves and the grunts of their mothers, the nasal hoots of rutting bucks. And beneath it all, like the beating of a great heart, the steady drumming of thousands of hooves. Torak had only ever seen small groups of reindeer in the forest. Awestruck, he watched the herd flowing slowly, purposefully, endlessly across the river. The hill where he lay dropped steeply through a thicket of willows to a flat expanse of gravelly riverbank, then rose again to another hill, also thick with willows. He guessed that the gap in between was one of the reindeer's ancient crossing places. Finkedin had once told him that the herds have followed the trails of their ancestors for thousands of winters. He saw how they converged in a dense press of bodies as they passed through the gap. He saw the lifted heads and jostling antlers of swimming reindeer, the quick heave as they climbed the banks and scattered on the other side. He knew that this river of life would be trailed by many hunters. Eagles, wolves, ravens, wolverines, people. But where were the people? He spotted Rip and Wreck flying high, turning their heads from side to side as they searched for carcasses. He saw a buck rise on its hind legs and run a few paces to warn the others of danger, then thud to earth and charge a wolverine who bounded away. And there in the distance was Wolf, a grey shadow at the edge of the herd, seeking an abandoned calf or a reindeer too sick or injured to put up a fight. But no people. Just three more turf men on the hill opposite, standing with antler arms outstretched. Wren whispered in his ear, "We're out of arrow shot. We've got to get downhill into the thicket." She was right. Forget about people. The only thing that mattered now was meat.
That was Michelle Paver. Ghost Hunter is published by Orion. And I have to say, Tennyson could have taken some lessons from her on reading aloud, Sarah, couldn't he?
That's just a little bit.
But anyway, we're now going back to poetry. And as you probably know, National Poetry Day fell on Thursday, but it has provoked a fever of activity all week, from a series of haikus from Roger McGough to mark Monday's tube strike, to the publication of a previously unknown poem by Ted Hughes, written immediately after the death of his estranged wife, Sylvia Plath. The poem was discovered by Melvyn Bragg, an old friend of Hughes, who described it as the missing link. Handwritten in a notebook, it opens, "What happened that night, your final night?" and ends hauntingly, "Your wife is dead." Sarah is our poetry expert, so I'm leaving it up to her to give us a quick critique. Sarah, what exactly does Melvyn mean by the missing link?
Well, I think that what he means is that this is, in many ways, the central moment. And we thought Hughes had never written about it. He's written about his life with Plath. He then wrote about his existence after her death in birthday letters, but never about the moment of her suicide itself or about how he experienced it, how he felt about it. And also there's the other sort of side to this is that suicide is, by its nature, such an individual, lonely act. And Hugh says later on in the poem, "What happened that night inside your hours is as unknown as if it never happened." And that's kind of the missingness is there, isn't it? It's that sense of absence, of nothingness, of emptiness. And I think possibly that's what he's talking about. This poem takes us directly into the eye of the storm.
Now, when we first heard about it on Wednesday afternoon, we actually wondered if it might be a hoax. How could such a very significant poem have remained undiscovered for so long?
I suppose because it's so significant. It's such a personal poem. If anyone has a copy of The New Statesman, you can see that Hughes has worked it over and over again. Corrections and crossings outs and amendments. And I don't think it looks to me that he wasn't happy with it. He wasn't convinced that it was in a publishable state, so he didn't publish it, which puts Melvyn Bragg in quite an interesting position, I think. We get back to the old question of if Hughes didn't publish it himself, ought it now to have been published after his death? And there is something slightly ghoulish, I think, about, you know, the fascination, the inevitable fascination with a poem by Hughes on the path to suicide.
It was, of course, with the blessing of Hughes's widow.
Yes. I find it confusing, to be honest. I don't really understand why she would have okayed it.
But perhaps because all his work has gone into the British Library anyway.
I suppose so, and it's a matter of record and all of that sort of thing. But if he didn't publish it, ought it to have been published? I don't really know.
Well, Hughes, of course, has been vilified by generations of Plath groupies. It's changed a bit with birthday letters, but yeah. Will this change his reputation yet again, bring him yet again further back into estimation?
It'll certainly bring him back into discussion. All of the old conversations about who's to blame, Hughes or Plath, it's like a sort of a horrible soap opera that we're all addicted to, you know, who's at fault, and people always seem to take a side. And I think that Hughes has always been held up as this sort of cold, adamantine figure, the rock against which Plath dashed herself. And this poem certainly shows that he's not completely rock-like. You might not agree with his actions, but the emotions are very raw in it. I don't know, it made me think of there's a line in W.H. Auden's poem in memory of W.B. Yeats when he says of Yeats, he became his admirers. And I think that's what's happened with Plath and Hughes. They're not themselves anymore. They've been disseminated. They belong to their respective publics.
Well, it's a bit of a melancholy note for a week that's supposed to be a celebration of poetry. And on the very same day, it was announced that Seamus Heaney, born only 9 years after Hughes, has won one of the year's Premier Poetry Awards, the Forward Prize for Best Collection. His winning collection, Human Chain, also has intimations of mortality, as we found out on this podcast 3 weeks ago, when we were lucky enough to listen in to him reading live at the Poetry Prom.
One morning in County Donegal, I woke up paralysed down my left side. But luckily, sound of speech and memory all in the end turned out fine. But when I was in hospital, I got to thinking of that famous incident in the New Testament where the paralytic is brought in for healing, and there's such a crowd around Christ they can't get him through the crowd. So they take him up to the roof, take off the tiles, and lower him for healing. And with my new perspective on things, the guys who carry him in become more and more important in that story. I hadn't noticed them before, but after getting help, I realized it was a very good story about them too. So this is called Miracle. Not the one who takes up his bed and walks, but the ones who have known him all along and carry him in. Their shoulders numb. They ache and stoop, deep locked in their backs. The stretcher handles slippery with sweat. And no let up until he's strapped on tight, made tiltable, and raised to the tiled roof, then lowered for healing. Be mindful of them as they stand and wait for the burn of the paid out ropes to cool, their slight lightheadedness and incredulity to pass, those ones who had known him all along.
The great Seamus Heaney reading Miracle from his Forward Prize-winning collection, Human Chain. The Poetry Prom, where he read it, was at Aldborough. It's not to be confused with the Aldborough Poetry Festival, which runs from the 5th to the 7th of November. Now, both Sarah and I have been judges at the Forward Poetry Prizes in the past, and you may have noticed the plural there. That's because it's not just one, but three prizes for Best Collection, Best First Collection, and Best Single Poem. The single poem, I have to admit, particularly taxed me. It made me wonder whether I actually had any idea at all as to what made a great poem. And one reason I found it so hard was because in the particular year that I judged it, we gave the prize for best first collection to a book in which no individual poems were substantial enough to have won on their own merit. Now, as I've said, Sarah's a bit of a poetry buff, so I've asked her to give us a short masterclass in this year's winning poem, An Easy Passage, which is read for us by its author, Julia Copus.
Once she is halfway up there, crouched in her bikini, on the porch roof of her family's house, trembling. She knows that the one thing she must not do is to think of the narrow windowsill, the sharp drop of the stairwell. She must keep her mind on the friend with whom she is half in love, and who is waiting for her on the blonde gravel somewhere beneath her. Keep her mind on her and on the fact of the open window, the flimsy, hole-punched aluminium lever, towards which, in a moment, she will reach with the length of her whole body, leaning in to the warm flank of the house. But first she steadies herself, still crouching, the grains of the asphalt hot beneath her toes and fingertips, a square of petrified beech. Her tiny breasts rest lightly on her thighs. What can she know of the way the world admits us less and less the more we grow? For now, both girls seem lit as if from within, their hair and the gold stud earrings in the first one's ears. For now, the house exists only for them, set back as it is from the long grey eye of the street and far away from the mother who does not trust her daughter with a key. The workers about their business in the drab electroplating factory over the road. Far too, most far, from the flush-faced secretary, who, with her head full of the evening class she plans to take, or the trip of a lifetime, looks up now, from the stirring omens of the astrology column, at a girl, 13 if she's a day, standing in next to nothing in the driveway opposite, one hand flat against her stomach, one shielding her eyes to gaze up at a pale calf, a silver anklet, and the five neat, shimmering oyster-painted toenails of an outstretched foot, which catch the sunlight briefly, like the flash of armaments, before dropping gracefully into the shade of the house.
Julia Copas reading An Easy Passage. The judges praised it for its unsettling strangeness, the shifts of perspective and confident line. The main thing I noticed about it, Sarah, was its frame of reference, and it was very modern. I noticed there weren't any larks or blackbirds in it.
Yes, I thought that its plainness was one of the really nice things about it. It's taking a very, very small moment, something that barely even qualifies as a moment, really, and casting it and extending it and looking at all the implications of it, sort of forwards and backwards in time. And I think it's the mark of a great poem to capture a moment like that and to make it vibrate and make the hairs rise on our legs because it's all so tingly and loaded, I suppose.
It reminded me quite a lot of T.S. Eliot's Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock.
Yeah, there's that lovely line about the secretary with her head full of the evening
class. The flush-faced secretary.
Yeah. Which sounds just like Eliot, I agree. I think it's definitely a sort of a nod or a reference. Well, actually, we asked Julia this morning when she came in and she said not exactly, but she was glad that it was in there. That it's, I guess, you know, I mean, it's difficult, that sort of thing. It's difficult to know whether, you know, something's drifted into your head and then come out through the pen or not. And that kind of that mundanity as well, that everydayness, which is so Eliot, is very present here.
Well, let's just go back a moment to the Roger McGough haikus I mentioned at the start of the podcast. One of them in particular provoked a flurry of argument on our website. And since haikus are rather short, Sarah, I wonder if you would quote it in full for us.
Yes, it goes, platforms yawn and stretch, enjoying the holiday, mice minding the gap.
And here's what our website commenters thought of it. Utter drivel, wrote Cynically Positive. This kind of whimsical poetry which reacts to daily events is good fun and has a long tradition, though mostly in bardic poetry, responded Yahoo. Bards were there to sing for warriors, objected Gordon Bunt. I hope I've pronounced you correctly. They sang for whoever paid, responded Yahoo, and so it goes on. You can read the whole correspondence on guardian.co.uk/books. Now, it's all a bit of fun, but Sarah, does it raise any important points? I mean, particularly about context.
Certainly, yes. I guess the point is that poems can have different functions and do different things. They can make you meditate on a moment, like Julia Copas's poem. They can speak sort of widely and generally and heartfeltedly, if that's such a word, as Seamus Heaney's poem did. Or they can just be a little throwaway thing that, you know, captures a moment and is enjoyable and sort of pinpoints, I suppose, something that we're thinking. Yeah, I thought this was actually really good, particularly because of the yawning and the stretching of the platforms, which gives you, you know, it's anthropomorphizing the platform. It's, you know, a person yawning and stretching on a day off. But also there's that kind of sense of the length of the platform, the way it stretches away and the yawn like a gap yawns, you know. It's really good.
I also quite like the mice minding the gap. Although a lot of people on our comment thread really objected to that. And I think probably along the lines of people's objections to blackbirds and larks, as I mentioned earlier.
These are reasonable objections, I suppose.
Anyway, one of the things that distinguishes the good from the bad and the indifferent is whether a poem stands the test of time. I mean, who today has heard of Colley Cibber, the 18th century poet laureate whose Faustian, according to Alexander Pope, is so sublimely bad it is not prose but poetry run mad. We heard a snippet earlier on of Tennyson reading Charge of the Light Brigade. It's one of the gems from a treasure trove of archive recordings released this week by the British Library in two box sets of CDs from English and American poets. Here's the Welsh windbag Dylan Thomas reading.
It was my 30th year to heaven, woke to my hearing from harbour and neighbour wood, and the mussel pooled and the heron priested shore. The morning beckon with water praying and call of seagull and rook and the knock of sailing boats on the net-webbed wall. Myself to set foot that second in the still sleeping town and set forth. My birthday began with the water birds and the birds of the winged trees flying my name above the farms and the white horses. And I rose in rainy autumn and walked abroad in a shower of all my days. High tide and the heron dived when I took the road over the border and the gates of the town closed as the town awoke. A springful of larks in a rolling cloud, and the roadside bushes brimming with whistling blackbirds, and the sun of October, summery on the hill's shoulder. Here where fond climates and sweet singers suddenly come in the morning where I wandered and listened to the rain ringing wind blow cold in the wood far away under me.
Dylan Thomas reading Poem in October from the covetable British Library CD sets of English and American poets. And if any of my friends are listening, that's what I want for Christmas, and I don't mind if you all club together and it's all I get. Now, Sarah, we praise Julia Coppice for having no larks, and Dylan has a whole sky full of them. What is this, a corny old poem now, or do we actually think it's still good?
I think it teeters on the brink of corniness, but that's kind of the glory of Dylan Thomas. I was absolutely nuts for Dylan Thomas when I was a teenager, and I used to read Under Milkwood again and again, and I think it's perfect poetry for teenagers because it has that sort of over richness, like chocolate souffle. It's baroque, it's just sort of wonderful and tangible. But the thing is that it does hold up. If you come back to it as an adult, it still kind of sustains itself. The images do work. When he talks about the heron priested shore, I think, in the first stanza, you know exactly what he means, and there is something clerical about herons, and so it sort of works. But I actually find his poetry quite difficult to talk about and to deconstruct, because it's all about the physical assault of it. It kind of crashes over you and leaves you gasping, especially when you hear him reading it in the kind of really overstated way that he does.
I think that you made a really interesting point there, actually, which is about teenagers, and which, of course, brings us back to the importance of literature for young people. And particularly with poetry, often the ones that stay with you are the ones that you read at a particularly intense time of your life.
Well, I had a conversation with a teacher friend of mine about this, and we were talking about the fact that when we thought about poets, when we thought about the idea of poets, it was always Byron and Shelley and Keats, you know, the romantics, they were the real poets. The poets who you meet as a teenager and who are so sort of filled with the life force and throbbing with emotion and passion, and that's what you think poetry is. And then as you get older, you know, well, I mean, Yeats is another good example. When I was younger, I really loved all his Pre-Raphaelite wordy verbose stuff, and now as an adult, I'm just, you know, I think all of that's a bit daft, really, and I much prefer his much plainer stuff from later on.
And that's it for this week's podcast. Thanks to Michelle Paver and Michelle Pawley. Congratulations to Seamus Heaney and Julia Coppice. Do join Sarah and me again next week. In the meantime, in the Guardian Saturday Review tomorrow, William Boyd writes about the new Nobel laureate Mario Vargas Llosa. In the Observer's new review on Sunday, Rachel Cook interviews Saul Bellow's widow in advance of a new edition of his letters. I'm off now to renew my acquaintance with Vargas Llosa's work. I've put out a bit of a request for recommendations, and the ones that seem to be coming back are War at the End of the World, Death in the Andes, and Conversations in the Cathedral. I'll also be reading my way through the rest of the Booker shortlist in preparation for next week's podcast. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead, and the producer is Tim Mabey.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.